Hello and welcome to the LSTM podcast series, where we meet some of the most curious minds in science. I'm Lee Bowman, and this month we hear from Dr. Eleanor McPherson, who researches the impact of social factors on vulnerability to disease. Then we listen to John Dusabe, who is conducting PhD research on the effect of a text message-based referral system on health service uptake. First up, we hear from Dr. Eleanor McPherson, interviewed by Kayla Barnes.
Today I'm speaking with Dr. Eleanor McPherson, a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of International Public Health here at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Ellie researches how broader social factors shape vulnerability to diseases with a focus on gender, HIV, and neglected tropical diseases. Eleanor, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Kayla.
HIV and sexually transmitted diseases continue to cause high morbidity, mortality, and economic burdens on many families living in developing countries. These risks are shaped by a wide range of factors, including where people live, such as urban or peri-urban areas, what they do for a living, and how old they are. You recently carried out a two-year qualitative study exploring this disease burden in one of the largest fishing communities in Malawi. Can you tell us a little bit more about the HIV burden in this area, as well as your study design?
Sure, Kayla. So my study was based in the Mangochi district of Malawi, which is in the southern region. Lake Malawi is a vast freshwater lake that covers 15% of the whole surface area of Malawi. However, in terms of fishing, the most prevalent areas are within the south, so this leads to a large migration from the north to the south of the lake. And the Mangochi district, where the study was situated, has quite a high HIV prevalence rate of about 13%, which is, for a rural district, higher than average. And what's likely to be the reason for this high levels of HIV prevalence is the presence of fishing communities, which have been found globally to be highly vulnerable to HIV.
So these fishing communities create vulnerability in women because there's movement of men and there's some level of transactional sex going on, as I think you explored in your study. But what is transactional sex? What does that encompass? Can you define that a little bit more for us?
Sure. So transactional sex is the exchange of sex for gifts or money for material benefits. In my study, we found that the fishing communities are highly gendered, with men undertaking the fishing and women carrying out the processing and selling of the fish at markets. Transactional sex was a key way that women within the communities accessed fish, so either for sale, also for transportation to the market. But if when they got their fish to the market and they'd made a loss, transactional sex was a way of women recouping this loss and having sex, often with richer male fish traders.
So this creates a power struggle and definitely vulnerability in women. And one way that HIV researchers have tried to address this in other areas is using microfinance. It's been a major tool to help empower women. But your study showed a very interesting dynamic between microfinance, empowerment, and transactional sex.
Sure. So obviously poverty is a big driver of HIV in these fishing communities, and microfinance has been seen as a potential tool to alleviate poverty in rural women. It began in Bangladesh in the 1980s and has been rolled out across the world. However, what we found in our study was that microfinance loans, so the lending of small loans to rural women in group-based lending, could actually increase women's vulnerability. This was because of the way that microfinance was put into practice on the ground. This included very short repayment processes, so women had to repay their loans within 2 weeks to a month, as well as the group-based lending, which meant that women were all responsible for the loan. The group together repaid the loan, and therefore, if one woman was struggling, the rest of the group could place a lot of pressure on this woman to repay. Another factor in this was that at the beginning of the loan cycle, within the group, women had to register property as collateral against the loan. And then if women were struggling, they would then the group would confiscate and sell their property as a way of repaying the loan. So it could be very disempowering for women working in the fishing communities if they had made a loss, which was quite often because it was a highly unpredictable environment.
So this creates a really complex situation between things like microfinance, empowerment, transactional sex. Did your study shed any light, or were you able to make any recommendations to try to decrease some of the burden on women?
Sure. So I think there's two components of the recommendations, really. Firstly, it's about how microfinance is put into practice on the ground, particularly with women working in highly seasonal industries. I think the removal of the potential to confiscate property and the relaxing of these very tight repayment periods are two key aspects that need to be thought about in terms of reform. And the second component is actually looking at the more broad aspects of why women are particularly socially vulnerable in these communities. Microfinance has been seen as this magic bullet for many other aspects, and actually I think there is no magic bullet when we think about vulnerability to disease, because it is so multifaceted. So I think if we think about changing these broader structures in terms of education, perhaps in terms of cash transfers that are in no way linked to repayments, and also thinking about men within this situation and how we can change men's social environment, that can also reduce the vulnerability of women.
This study sheds light on a lot of aspects of vulnerability in women, especially in regards to HIV and other neglected tropical diseases. Thank you for this interview. I'm sure that there'll be much more information coming out about this. And if you would like to find out more about Eleanor's work, you can visit her staff profile at the LSTM website. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Eleanor and Kayla. Now we move on to John DeSave, interviewed by Chris Spencer.
My interview today is with John DeSave. After having completed his master's degree at the University of Oxford, John came to LSTM in 2010 and has since been conducting research into reproductive health in Tanzania and Niger. John's going to tell us today about his PhD research. Hi there, John.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Right, I'll just jump straight in then. Your PhD project was on the effect of a text messaging-based referral system on sexual reproductive health service uptake. So, at the beginning of the project, how did you go about planning and designing the intervention?
We wanted to an intervention that incorporated the communities and providers, this prototype desired interventions. So we involved them through the process and the situation analysis. We consulted the clinicians, we consulted the drugstores, the communities through adolescents, and then we triangulated their views, and then went back and consulted them on whether they had accessibility to mobile phones and how they used them. So we designed then an intervention around those views.
So given that, what form did the intervention take?
The intervention followed an implementation research methodology. We designed it with an mHealth technology company that is based in London. So the referral system followed the drugstores, basically allowed the drugstores to send text messages to dispensaries through an automatic and randomly generated passwords. Then the dispensaries received the text messages, treated patients, and texted the drugstores as a form of feedback. Then we captured these text message exchanges automatically in real time and analyze those exchanges to estimate the impact of the intervention.
So with that analysis, what could you gauge were the achievements of the intervention?
We had very positive feedback achievements because we were working with only 18 health facilities and 52 drugstores in two districts, so it wasn't a massive intervention. And within 18 months, we achieved more than 1,000 referrals, and up to 40% of these referrals that from the drugstores actually proceeded to the health facilities. And of those 40% who went to the health facility, 20% of them among men and 22% of them had STIs. 8% of them had HIV, which is actually 8% is above the national average, which is 5% at the moment. There were no differences between males and females in terms of accessing services, which I think shows how equitable the intervention was in that respect. We went and conducted a randomized household survey in the communities, and 92% of those who were referred said that in future they would accept the intervention again. Facilities and the drugstores evaluated it positively, although the drugstores are actually business traders who basically make profit out of selling drugs, but actually they accepted the intervention and said that they would want to continue doing it. So the intervention was effective.
So given these achievements, can you talk about what you think the impact of the project will be and what hopes you have for the future?
In terms of the implications for future research, obviously with these achievements we still need to evaluate this type of intervention in a randomized trial kind of setting, and see whether these results we've got actually could there is evidence to suggest that the intervention really, really would work if we have a control. Then we need to also evaluate its cost effectiveness to see how actually it can benefit the ministry, because we didn't do this in this intervention. However, the districts and the regional health officials were really interested in the intervention, and they went with us through the 18-month period. They were with us, they went with us, they like gave us freeholds to train the health, the clinicians and things like that. And at the moment they are lobbying the ministry at the national level to see whether they can include the intervention outputs within their budgets, so that they can continue implementing, because the system is still live at the moment, although I stopped collecting data. So I think for the future, I think that the impact is actually that the communities want the intervention and they're interested in it. The district and the regional officials are interested in the project, and if the ministry can take it on, that would be a good impact, I think.
So this project is excellent. It's reaching people that otherwise wouldn't be either reached or treated, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, when you look at it in Tanzania, in the rural areas where we worked, almost everybody has access to mobile phones, which is really a very good avenue. And we are looking at the cases of HIV, cases of STIs that would never have reached the health facility, would have ended up at the drugstore level, and they wouldn't have been properly managed. And this intervention has managed to bring those cases up and managed actually to raise the awareness. The health promotion aspect of it has actually impacted on health facilities having the ability to be the first port of call to treat such cases that would otherwise not have been treated.
Thank you very much for your time today, John. If you'd like to read some more about this, you can look at John's staff profile on the LSTM website. There's a paper in the Journal of Telemedicine and Telecare, and an upcoming paper in the BMJ. Best of luck in your upcoming Viva, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to both John and Chris for the interview. That's it for the November podcast. We'll be taking a break for the month of December, but hope you'll join us for a special edition in January 2015, brought to you by the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine.